5:55 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting Syrian government forces advance. The Syrian army, backed by Iranian militia and Russian airstrikes, is advancing toward the Turkish border, pushing rebels out of at least two towns north of Aleppo. Russia has been bombarding rebel-held areas for days, causing tens of thousands of civilians to flee to Turkey and camps along the border. Ankara is already caring for 2.5 million Syrians. U.S. spokesman John Kirby says Washington has been in close consultations with Moscow over the strikes.
We have talked a lot about this with them, and you heard the secretary address this very issue on Friday. And that's why he believes this upcoming meeting in Munich is important on Thursday to deal with this exact issue. And he's been very clear that Russian support for the Assad regime is doing nothing but prolonging the conflict, helping attract jihadis and foreign fighters to the effort. Obviously, it's increasing the flow of refugees, and it's harming innocent people.
Turkey's deputy prime minister warned his country may face as many as 600,000 additional Syrian refugees. Meanwhile, the U.S. has welcomed a Saudi offer to deploy special forces to support a possible coalition ground operation inside Syria. At least 21 people were killed and dozens more wounded in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo amid rising ethnic tensions. The violence pits Hutus against other local groups, including ethnic Nande and Nyanga. The U.N. also reports massive displacement of civilians and instances of looting, rape, and abductions, as well as arson. Ethnic rivalries and competition for mineral-rich land have stoked persistent conflict among eastern Congo's dozens of rebel groups. This is VOA News. UN investigators have accused Syria of carrying out a massive extermination of detainees among its civilian population, alleging that it amounts to a crime against humanity. Paulo Pinheiro is chairman of the Independent Commission of Inquiry on Syria.
Detainees are subjected to violations on a mass scale in governmental detention centers. Prisoners are routinely tortured and beaten, forced to live in unsanitary and overcrowded cells with little food and no medical care. Many perish in detention.
The UN investigation, based on interviews with hundreds of survivors and witnesses of prison life, said the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad is holding tens of thousands of detainees at any one time. Thousands more have disappeared after their arrests or after being abducted by armed groups. At least 35 migrants drowned in the Aegean Sea Monday trying to reach Greece from Turkey. Turkey's Coast Guard rescued seven as two boats sank in separate accidents. The latest fatalities drive the death toll for Mediterranean crossings to nearly 400 since the new year. The Syrian refugee Mustafa was one of the fortunate survivors who made the dangerous journey.
I've been to people because the people have children and want to peace. And all people want to stop war in Syria because many people in Syria, your house is very finished. Don't have house, don't have money, don't have work. And stop war and open because if the war in Syria is enough, all people, Syrian, we will back to Syria and building Syria.
The International Organization for Migration says more than 75,000 migrants and refugees have arrived by sea to Greece and Italy since January 1st. Rescuers in Taiwan are using cranes, dogs, and electronics to search for survivors from Saturday's apartment building collapse in Tainan City following a 6.4 magnitude earthquake. The death toll stands at 38. Hundreds have been rescued, but more than 100 remain under debris. Engineer Changming Chang says there remain signs of life, so rescuers are being very careful. He says some barricades have been removed. The chances of surviving diminish as those trapped beneath the rubble have no access to food and water. The chief executive of Dalo Airlines Monday said the man suspected of detonating a bomb on board one of his company's planes a week ago initially intended to board a Turkish Airlines flight. CEO Mohammed Ibrahim said most of the passengers in the flight intended to travel to Djibouti on a Turkish flight, but it was canceled. U.S. presidential candidates made their final appeals for votes ahead of Tuesday's New Hampshire primary election. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations seeks to eliminate female circumcision by the year 2030.
And today, nearly all countries where it is prevalent outlaw the practice. We are working to extend the legal protection everywhere.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Work resumes to incorporate South Sudan's peace agreement into the country's transitional constitution. A no means no program targets sexual violence in Kenya, and Zimbabwe appeals for funding to avert food shortages.
We realize that quite a number have now fallen into the drought situation for the 2016, and we believe that almost 2.4 million people, 26% of our population, are food insecure.
Xavier Kasuku Were, Zimbabwe's public works minister, used books Get a New Life on the streets of Lagos, Nigeria, and we'll take you to the conclusion of Guinea-Bissau's carnival festivities. Those stories plus Mark Ouma's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations warned yesterday that millions of girls remain at risk of female genital mutilation. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir reports.
The practice, which involves removing all or part of a girl's external genitalia, has no health benefit and can cause severe bleeding, infection, pain, and later complications in childbirth. Some girls die from the procedure. Colombian lawyer and anti-FGM activist Patricia Tobon lost three aunts to the practice. She's heard here through an interpreter.
When I was 9 years old, my mother told me that three of her sisters had died because their grandmother practiced FGM on them, but her mother rescued her and her other sister from it.
Tobon is a member of the indigenous Embera people, the only ethnic group in Latin America known to practice female circumcision. The tradition is more widely practiced in parts of Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. The UN Population Fund, which works to educate people about FGM's dangers, estimates that more than 125 million girls alive today have been subjected to circumcision in 29 countries. Malian singer and activist Ina Moja underwent FGM when she was 4 years old.
I had the physical pain and I also had the psychological pain because I felt that I would never become a woman, because I had something missing.
She later had reconstructive surgery, which she said helped her to heal, because she was doing something to get back what was taken from her. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told a special event on eliminating female circumcision that since 2007, more than a dozen countries have enacted measures to tackle the practice.
And today, nearly all countries where it is prevalent outlaw the practice. We are working to extend the legal protection everywhere.
But several countries where it is prevalent have not outlawed it, including Mali, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Sudan, Yemen, and Iraq. Outlawing it also does not guarantee that the law is enforced. The practice also has migrated to Western countries with immigrants. In most European countries, FGM is prosecutable under general criminal laws. In the United States, it is illegal to transport girls to undergo the procedure. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Zimbabwe yesterday appealed to domestic and international donors for assistance as more than a quarter of its population faces hunger. As Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA, the United Nations says President Robert Mugabe's government must invest in irrigation to avert perennial food shortages.
Zimbabwe says nearly 2.5 million people are facing starvation and blames the problem on the El Nino weather phenomenon that has caused drought in southern Africa. Zimbabwe's Public Works Minister, Xavier Kasuku Were, says the government is assessing the situation.
We're still working on the numbers, and I'm sure we'll be able to give the world locally and, of course, outside kind of an estimate of what we're looking at. But we realize that quite a number have now fallen into the drought situation for the 2016, and we believe that almost 2.4 million people, 26% of our population, are food insecure.
Chimimba David Piri is the Southern Africa coordinator for the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Piri said he expects Zimbabwean officials to revise that figure upward as El Nino weather worsens. He said governments should encourage conservation agriculture so their citizens are less vulnerable to weather changes.
In addition to that, we need very much to increase area under irrigated production. There are many schemes in Zimbabwe, some that are dormant now, but that require rehabilitation. Zimbabwe in Southern Africa has the highest number of water points and dams and rivers and so on. So there is water in Zimbabwe, perhaps more than any other country in this sub-region, which can be used very, very well for irrigation. In the past, it used to happen. Now, there's no reason why it can't happen now.
Zimbabwe, once a breadbasket of Southern Africa, has been a net importer of food since the early 2000s. President Mugabe attributes that to recurring droughts in the region, but critics of the Zimbabwean leader say the country's controversial land reform program, which forced most experienced white commercial farmers off their land, is causing hunger in the nation. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The committee tasked with incorporating South Sudan's recent peace agreement into the constitution resumed its work yesterday after sitting on the sidelines for nearly 2 weeks due to disagreements between the government and the armed opposition over President Salva Kiir's creation of 28 states and other issues. The National Constitutional Amendment Committee says it has put on hold all outstanding issues until the transitional government of national unity is formed. Nabil Biajo of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
The National Constitutional Amendment Committee is supposed to draft a constitution for South Sudan before the transitional government is formed, but adjourned last month after the two warring parties could not agree on President Kiir's newly created 28 states. Committee member Abraham Biya represents the government side.
We stopped originally because of one, there is a question of 10 states and 28 states. That decision needs a political leadership decision. The second issue was a question of whether there will be a by-election during the transitional period of 30 months. That one also is not provided in the peace agreement. To the government side, we believe there shall not be any election beyond the 30 months, part of the transitional period.
The disagreements over the number of states and elections led to delays in forming the transitional government of national unity, which is supposed to be based on the new constitution. On January 31st, IGAD's Council of Ministers issued a communique urging the government and the SPLM in opposition to stop delaying and form the transitional government without a new constitution in place. The communique also called on the government to freeze all activities related to establishing the 28 states. BR says the Constitution Committee will now focus on provisions on which the two parties agree.
We start with the process of cleaning the document, excluding this question of 28 states from our agenda for a further decision by the leadership.
Committee member BL Boutros, BL represents the SPLM in opposition.
There were contentious issues, and one of which was 28 states, which was introduced, a willful violation by the government of the agreement. And then also, the government would like to maintain the presidential advisors in the constitution, but the agreement does not provide for the presidential advisors. It tempers with the power sharing.
Zakaria Ding Akol, a senior analyst at the local think tank, the SUD Institute, says the decision by IGAD to move on without a constitution was an inadequate solution to the stalemate over states.
This reflects the frustration that IGAD and others, including South Sudanese, have with the parties not being able to move forward.
Akol says it's true that the peace agreement can override the constitution, but he says South Sudan still needs a constitution. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biajo in Juba.
Today's Tuesday, February 9th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington, and still to come, Mark Oldman's sports in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Used booksellers are importing books from abroad and selling them on the streets of Africa's largest city. What's popular with readers may surprise you. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
Among the piles of books sold on sidewalks in Nigeria's economic capital, Lagos, you can find the memoirs of American presidential candidates Donald Trump and Ben Carson. You can find self-help texts lying next to phrase books of the local Igbo, Hausa, and Yoruba languages. It's Ogbono Osiri's business to keep Nigeria's used book sellers supplied. He fills containers with secondhand books from overseas and brings them to merchants in Nigeria.
So people can stay in my warehouse from morning to night looking for books. They can just make out one day. Be spending here, searching for books.
At his sidewalk stall in the bustling Lagos Island business district, Solomon Rabio sells everything from John Grisham and Tom Clancy paperbacks to works by Nigerian authors like Chinua Achebe.
The books that I sell most, they are all motivational books. You know, the motivational books, people use it for some form of a business plan, some other thing. People buy a lot.
Imported secondhand books compete with those published by local outfits like CSS Bookshops. The publishing house has been in business since 1869. CSS prints, publishes, and sells school textbooks, biographies, and Christian texts. But managing director Dotun Adeboyega says the biggest threat to his business is piracy.
People do not have money, you know, to buy the good books. In fact, most of the people buy pirated books. That is the major problem facing the industry.
Many of these counterfeit books are printed abroad and imported into Nigeria. He called for more action by the government to staunch the flow. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The organizers of an initiative to reduce and stop rape in the informal settlements around Kenya's capital say their program is having marked success. Girls are taking self-defense classes while the boys are learning how to protect the girls and respect them at the same time. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
Mary Ojwaka listens intently during a self-defense class. Today, she's one of 50 girls taking a lesson in close contact defense techniques. No! Ojwaka lives in Korogosho, an informal settlement on the outskirts of Kenya's capital, Nairobi. She's attending the classes so she has the means to ward off any attacks of sexual violence.
The classes are helpful because they teach girls who don't know how to defend themselves. If men come and try to assault, then they now know how to defend themselves.
Ujamaa, the non-governmental organization that runs the No Means No campaign, says one out of every four women in Nairobi's informal settlements has been a victim of sexual assault. The girls undergo 6 weeks of training in which they learn both verbal and physical skills to ward off attacks. Project coordinator Nancy Omondi says the program has faced some resistance from men who sometimes resent being portrayed as perpetrators of rape. But the No Means No campaign also includes classes for boys. In Nairobi's Isili suburb, high school students at St. Teresa's Boys School are attending a class called Your Moment of Truth, which encourages the boys to stand up and protect girls against sexual assault. 18-year-old Patrick Makau has been taking the training for 3 years now. He says the classes have changed his perception of girls in society.
I'll be able to know the importance of respecting them, not taking them for granted. We as men or boys also, we should take these girls, our sisters, to protect them, not violate them.
Ujamaa runs the No Means No campaign in all of Nairobi's informal settlements. So far, around 30,000 young people have taken part since the program began 6 years ago. From the sound of it, the lessons of the program are sinking in. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
Guinea-Bissau wraps up its carnival festivities today, Tuesday, as teams from around the country perform dances, gymnastics, and more in a national parade in the capital. Each group displays a variety of traditions from various ethnic groups in the country. Some men wear life-size papier-mâché representations of nationalist heroes such as Amical Cabral, while spectators are decked out in more modern clothing, such as oversized bright pink sunglasses. Carnival spokesperson Rita Ayu took a break amid the festivities and talked to Ricky Stryak about this year's theme for the four-day-long party.
We think about a lot of things that can promote our culture, so we decide to choose a theme like the theme is rescue and promote our culture. That's the theme of this year for the carnival.
And what does that mean to promote Guinea-Bissau's culture?
Well, we saw that the culture of our people is getting a little bit lost. We are losing some of our identities, marks. They are losing, and we thought that maybe if we choose a theme that can make the people think about what is really important as a people, as a nation, that is very divided in many ethnic groups, but united by one thing, the culture. Culture is very important for our people. So it's the best way that we can use to show how is our identity.
Can you give me an example of some of those things? Like, what will people be doing to show the culture?
Each ethnic group have its own cultural identity. So we have many ethnic groups in our country. It's a very, it's a little country, but we have many ethnic groups. So each one of them have his own way of expression. Different dances of many ethnic groups like Pepel, Bijagoj, Fulas.
How many ethnic groups are there in total that will be celebrated?
I can say that in our country we have more than 30. There are ones that have more expression in terms of numbers, and there are others that are not so expressive, but
there are lots of different dances, it seems like, and different clothing for each group.
Yes.
But one thing that seems to be quite common is animals in all of the different dances and dress. And I believe another part of the carnival is celebrating Bissau's biodiversity. Is that correct?
Yes.
How do the two tie together?
Well, I think biodiversity and everything that's nature is something very important for us, because we have a strong connection with nature and animals and everything that is around us. We have a magnificent country. It's very important for us to preserve what is ours, what is not only our culture, but at the same time, the environment. We are very concerned about environmental problems, because since we know ourselves, we always been in connection with nature and everything that is that surrounds us. We have some animals that you cannot see in other part of the world, and we have a strong concern of trying to preserve that animal.
That was Rita A., spokesperson for Guinea-Bissau's National Carnival Committee. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the capital, Bissau. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Liberia Football Association President Musa Bility urges the FIFA Ad Hoc Election Committee head, Domenico Scala, to step aside from overseeing the FIFA presidential elections on the 26th of February. According to Bility, Scala is Swiss-Italian, just like Gianni Infantino, one of the candidates for the elections. Therefore, this presents a potential conflict of interest. Musa points out that Scala excused himself from the 2015 presidential elections, as Sepp Blatter is also Swiss. Turning to athletics, Mozambique's 2011 All-Africa Games 400-meter hurdles bronze medalist Kurt Kuto is looking forward to breaking new grounds this year. I caught up with him and asked him about his preparations for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics.
Every 4 years, for the past few years, I'd never thought I'd make this one, but here I am. And definitely the goal for this year will be to break 49 seconds.
Well, you've been at 49 seconds severally, including winning a World Student Games 400 silver medal at some stage in your career, and also the bronze medal at the All-Africa Games, the only medal Mozambique won at the All-Africa Games in 2011. Does that put a lot of pressure on you, given that you are their strongest medal prospect?
It does put on a little bit of pressure, but I guess you have to deal with it. I just have to use it in a positive way, seeing the pressure as a way for me to keep working hard on the track and keep motivating myself, Mark.
Well, prior to that, there's the Africa Championship here in South Africa. How does that fit into your overall plan for the year?
I think it might be ideal wherever they have it here in South Africa, because I do train here in South Africa and we are familiar with some of the things that are here in South Africa, and it's not a strange country to me. So it is ideal that they're hosting it here in South Africa, and it will be good preparation and a good indication of where we will be before Rio.
That was Kurt Kuto, Mozambique's 2011 All-Africa Games 400-meter hurdles bronze medalist, speaking in the South African capital, Tshwane. In Japan, Eritrea's Goitom Kifle and Kenyan Dominic Nyairo clinched a 1-2 African win in the Kagawa Murigame International Half Marathon on Sunday. Kifle covered the distance in 1 hour and 49 seconds, 1 second ahead of Nyairo. Burundi's Diane Nukuri was second in the women's race in 1 hour, 9 minutes and 23 seconds. And that's it for today. Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Stand up for your right. Get up.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 9th. On this day in 1944, African-American poet, novelist, and short story writer Alice Walker was born in Eatonton, Georgia, into a sharecropper family. Most of her writings talk about the lives of blacks in the South. In 1982, she published the novel The Color Purple, which won the Pulitzer Prize the following year. In 1985, the book was made into a movie starring Oprah Winfrey. Also on this day in 1906, African-American poet and novelist Paul Lawrence Dunbar died. Dunbar was the son of a slave. He was extremely popular for his poems about slave life on southern plantations. Did you know that Gwendolyn Brooks was the first African-American to receive the Pulitzer Prize? She received the award in 1950 for her work in poetry. Born in 1917, Brooks published her first poem when she was only about 13 years old. She later served a year as a consultant to the Library of Congress and taught creative writing at several colleges. And today in Black History, we want to tell you about the role the Buffalo Soldiers played in the settlement of the American West. Buffalo Soldiers were members of the Black Army units that served in the American West. They got their name from the Indians or Native Americans that they fought against. Their curly hair and bravery reminded the Native Americans of the buffalo, which the Indians respected very highly. Buffalo soldiers were commanded by white officers, but they took pride in wearing their uniform and serving their country. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 9th. Congratulations to Clement K.S. Tinnett of Sekomono in Ghana, Angelo Kasote of Mpika, Zambia, and Vish Maharaj of Durban, South Africa. You are the winners of our February 8th question. Who was the first African-American to be named president of the Harvard Law Review? The answer, Barack Hussein Obama, the 44th and 45th president of the United States. Now, here is our question for today, February 9th. Which civil rights leader wanted to build a black empire in Africa? Once again, which civil rights leader wanted to build a black empire in Africa? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Tuesday, February 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Tuesday on Health Chat. Host Lenore Modu continues her discussions about Zika virus with her guest, Dr. Oluwatosi Omeli, Family and Community Medicine, Howard University Hospital. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We'll call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat is Tuesday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.